Hello and welcome back to season 3 of Listening to the Dead.
In this episode, we're discussing forensic searches. Searches for bodies, searches for evidence, searches for criminals. And we're focusing on the tragic case of April Jones, the 5-year-old who went missing in Wales in 2012. The police search was one of the largest ever mounted. It lasted 6 months. And though an arrest was made of Mark Bridger, April's body was never found. Linda, these missing child cases are always highly emotional and heart-wrenchingly sad. Yet they remain some of the most widely reported cases in our media. And, you know, we can often remember the cases for years. I remember you saying you went to the trial of the Soham murderer. Why do you think we find them so appallingly compelling?
For one, I think the image of the child, also the anger. People get very, very angry. And constantly they put in the newspapers pictures the family have given of their missing child. So it becomes very, very relevant. And the anger that this could happen, because it is a parent's worst fear. I remember watching a detective explaining how he had found a child, the body of a child. It was 25 years ago, and yet still he welled up with tears, and he said, somebody did this to this newly born child. And even when I was filming for Trial and Retribution, a sequence that had a murdered child, and even the crew found it exceedingly difficult. And I've only ever done it once. I never ever went back to it, because emotionally it is absolutely appalling how you think someone could do that to a child.
In this episode, we reunite two forensic search experts who worked on the case in different capacities. It's my great pleasure to welcome Julie Roberts. Julie is a hugely experienced forensic anthropologist and archaeologist with some 20 years of practitioner experience in the location, recovery and identification of human remains from scenes of crime, war zones and mass fatality incidents. And back in 2012, she was called in to help in the search for April Jones. So Julie, April Jones went missing on the 1st of October. When were you called in to help on this case, and what are your memories of first hearing about it?
Well, we were initially contacted to assist with the analysis of environmental samples which had been recovered from footwear and from a vehicle belonging to Mark Bridger. So we weren't actually asked to help with the search on the ground. My team at the time dealt with all types of environmental evidence, so pollen, soils, plants, as well as the location identification of human remains. So the first request that we had from the police was to examine some soil samples which had been taken from Bridger's vehicle and from footwear. And the soil scientist was able to look at that and determine that the soils had come from an estuarine environment, so near a river. He presented those findings to the police and said that he could do more analysis on the soils to indicate perhaps a more precise location. But because by that time, Mark Bridger had already positioned himself within the search as a volunteer, the police decided that actually it was of minimal assistance because the soil could legitimately have been picked up whilst he was engaged in the search for April. So that was our first involvement with the case.
How soon after that were you called back again to look for human remains?
I can't remember exactly, but it was already the biologists at the laboratory where I was working were already involved in the case. And as part of their examinations in Mark Bridger's house, there was a thorough search. The crime scene investigators were searching throughout all the rooms in the property as well. And as part of their search, they recovered the contents of a wood-burning stove in the living room of Mark Bridger. And they were submitted to the lab for routine search and examination as everything was being searched from his property. So it was a search of the contents of that fire that was the next stage in our involvement in the case.
Julie, can I ask, was this a routine search or did the crime scene investigators already suspect that there might have been human remains at that scene?
No, so it was a routine search. So there was no question or no lines of inquiry at all at that point that there might be any human remains in the fire. It was just a belt and braces search of everything, of all the material in that property. So that was sent to us for examination to just see if there was anything of interest in the fire.
That's really interesting. Were you sent anything else to look at for evidence of possible human remains?
We were sent bits of plumbing apparatus. So we were sent parts of the U-bend from the sink, from the bathroom, from the toilet, just general plumbing equipment, pipes, that kind of thing, to see if there was anything trapped in those pipes as well.
Oh, wow.
But as far as having any kind of preconceived ideas about what might be in there, I'm not sure how much the police had actually formulated any kind of theories around that. As far as we were aware in the lab, this was a routine search just to see if there was any material of interest in there, in the pipes and in the fire.
Okay. And I mean, like you've got all these years of experience. I mean, presumably you'd done other large scale police operations like this. Is it standard practice that they send you everything from a person's home like this? You'd normally be searching through to plug hole remains and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's quite normal. And if there's any hint that a body has been disposed of, then everything, absolutely everything, is searched. So we have had cases in the past where we've been given drains to search, for example, silt traps from sinks, contents of washing machines, parts of washing machines. So anything that could be effectively used to dispose of either a body or evidence on clothing, for example, from washing machines. So it's not necessarily just body parts or human tissue. It might be other evidence that's come off clothing during the process of any kind of body disposal.
Okay. So you've got this ash and the detritus from a fire come to your lab and you start analysing. What are you using to analyse this material?
Just a standard low power microscope and visual examination to start with. So the initial search would just be sorting out the larger material from the smaller material. And this is usually done by a fairly junior forensic scientist. They'll go through and they'll examine all the material. They'll scan it. They'll scan the smaller material just by passing it underneath a low power light microscope to see if there's anything of interest. And then they would typically call on a reporting scientist, so a more senior scientist, to come and check their work and to look at anything that they've pulled out of there, which they might think is of interest, and also to scan over the material just in case they might have missed something.
Okay. And in this instance, how quickly did they identify the fact that there might be human remains here?
Really quickly. Yeah.
So they were. So what are we talking about? What sort of fragments are we talking about here? How big are they? What do they look like?
Well, the largest fragments were probably about maximum size, probably about 1.5 centimeters. The smallest fragments were a couple of millimeters.
And I mean, I'm just imagining that you're looking at this and you're thinking, right, so we've got bone here. How quickly can you establish where the bones come from, whether it's human or animal?
Well, first of all, we need to establish whether it's bone.
Okay.
So the initial thought process is this looks like burnt bone. And based on our experience and expertise, we think that this is burnt bone, but can we prove that it's burnt bone? So in a case like this, where it's so important to be able to back up your findings with scientific testing and knowledge and evidence for court, we did sample some of the smaller fragments and looked at them under a scanning electron microscope. So a scanning electron microscope not only produces very high magnification images, it also gives you an elemental profile of what that material's made of. So what we're looking for in that instance, if we suspect that something might be bone, is hydroxyapatite. And hydroxyapatite is the mineral component of bone. So it's mainly calcium and phosphate. And the problem here is that the fragments, the larger fragments, were so badly burnt that there was no organic material left in there for testing. So you are literally looking at the minerals and the elements, the chemical elements that are present. So to confirm that the profiles we were getting were bone, we were using a scanning electron microscope. Following that initial sampling to see if we could confirm that we'd got bone, that's when you start to look at whether you've got animal or human bone present and whereabouts it might have come from on the skeleton. Although we already had some thoughts on that, it's necessary to prove each stage as you go along.
So what were your initial thoughts?
Initial thoughts were that we had some pieces of cranial bone. So we had some pieces of bone from the skull. And that was based on the specific pattern of cranial sutures, so the joints which hold the skull bones together. They've got a very distinctive appearance. And there were a couple of the fragments that had the sutures present. And the other unique thing about fragments from the skull is that they're arranged in a double layer. So even though they're quite flat, you'll have an inner table, an outer table, and then spongy bone in the middle, called diploe. And that's very characteristic of the skull. So it's a flat bone with a very specific arrangement. And if you're lucky, you'll have a diagnostic piece with the cranial sutures on as well. So there were at least three fragments that had those features.
So is the electron microscope able to tell you whether it's human or animal bone?
No. The electron microscope will only tell you whether it's bone. It won't distinguish, because animal and human bone is the same chemical composition. So it will only tell you it's bone. To determine whether it's animal or human, then you have to be reliant on what we call comparative anatomy, which is basically your own knowledge, but also comparison of the small fragments with animal bones. So we took the samples along to the veterinary school at Liverpool University, and we made some morphological comparisons. So we compared the sutures, we measured them, we looked at them against animals of varying, lots of different species, lots of different sizes. And as all this was happening, the investigation was also progressing. So the defence were disclosing the work that we were carrying out, and Mark Bridger was providing reasons for our findings. So, for example, when we said there was bone in the fire, he replied by saying that he'd eaten animals and he'd thrown them on the fire afterwards. He was a survivalist, so he didn't just eat standard food that you and I might eat. He caught squirrels and he had ferrets and he had all sorts of wildlife. And he actually came up with a list of animals that could potentially have been on his fire, which ranged from ferrets, squirrels, chickens, horses, dogs, rats, a big list of animals. So every time an animal was mentioned, we checked that particular animal at the vet school to make comparisons, visual comparisons, bearing in mind we only had fragments of a centimetre in size. So from that point of view, some were very easy just because of the size. With a chicken, for example, you know, the thickness and the size of it, you know, it's never going to be a realistic option. But some of the animals were slightly more similar. So we made this morphological comparison with the samples at the vet school. But we then also went one stage further and we looked at the microscopic structure as well, which differs in animals and humans. And for that, we had to go to Milan and the Forensic Institute in Milan at a laboratory called Labanov, which is run by a forensic pathologist and anthropologist, Dr. Cristina Cattaneo, who is a leading name in bone histology and particularly looking at distinguishing between animal and human species. So She was able to do some thin sections of the bone and to look at the features under the microscope and provide opinion on whether she thought that the structures looked animal or human.
God, the list of professionals and analysis that you've gone through to get this, incredible. So you've now established that it's human. I suppose the next question would be, how can you tell it's from the same human?
Yeah, you can't. You can't, unfortunately. And just to put the caveat in about establishing that it's human, we couldn't 100% in scientific terms, because of the size of the fragments, Professor Cattaneo was only able to say there was nothing there to suggest it was animal and that everything was consistent with human, as opposed to being, this is 100%, I'm absolutely certain. So for that reason, we had to base our conclusions and findings on the combined evidence, so not just on one analysis alone, just because one analysis alone wouldn't support the entire opinion. So on the balance of probability, we had to assign levels of assurity, really, to each fragment to say how confident we were each fragment was animal or human. And it varied for each fragment depending on the features. So, for example, where we had cranial sutures and the histology looked animal, we could be more confident than a fragment where the histology looked animal, but we didn't have any other distinguishing features. And the reason that she was cautious was because she said if the fragments had been a bit bigger, there may have been some of the specific features associated with animal bone, but because they weren't bigger, she couldn't see that. Therefore, she couldn't 100% exclude it. So it all sounds a bit complicated, but actually it's just all about levels of confidence. But when we combine the different types of analyses, that's when you're able to strengthen your evidence. Mm. As far as saying whether the fragments belong together or not, that really because of the level of burning, because the fragments were what we call calcined, which means that all the organic matter has been burnt away. And that meant that we couldn't do DNA analysis and we couldn't do any kind of proteins analysis or anything that involved any organic biomolecular analyses of any kind. So it wasn't possible to confirm either identity or whether they belong to the same individual or not.
Good heavens. I knew fire could do quite a bit of damage to human remains, but not quite to that extent. So I'm wondering, is there any part of the human body that could have fared better in a fire? For example, maybe teeth?
Teeth are actually fare worse than bone in a fire. It's kind of the reverse from unburnt remains. So in unburnt remains, teeth will often survive better than bone because of the enamel. But what happens in a fire is that the enamel shatters quite early on. So the roots will be protected and any undeveloped teeth that are in the jaw are sometimes protected, but erupted teeth, the crowns will shatter. And that was what was quite unusual about this case. There were no tooth roots present. There were no other diagnostic fragments except small fragments of skull, really. There were some fragments that were so small that were 1 or 2 millimetres that we couldn't tell what they were. But certainly the fragments that came from the fire, the larger fragments, all seemed to be from the skull. And that there was a very small amount. And even when you burn a whole individual, even if they're only very young, you will get the whole skeleton surviving. So it doesn't completely disintegrate. It's the mechanical damage after the fire that causes the fragmentation, not necessarily the burning itself. So if you do burn a body, even if it's completely cremated and there's no organic material left, what you'll end up with is a mineral shell. So you'll end up with a whole skeleton still. But, you know, it can be compounded and it can be crushed, you know, which is why when we collect ashes from a funeral, for example, it's just a small couple of handfuls in an urn, but that's actually been pulverized into dust. What you're actually left with is a effectively a mineralized version of the skeleton when you cremate somebody, but there's no organic matter left in it.
It strikes me that, I mean, this is such a horrible case, such a tragic case. and so cruel. How do you keep your emotions out of it for you and the team? I mean, you're carrying bits of possibly a five-year-old child who's been hideously murdered and mutilated around to Spain and around the country. Is it quite difficult to keep yourself emotionless? And
it's always the same, really, when you're involved in any job that involves human remains, whatever the circumstances, and your focus is always on the job and always trying to get the best results, really. So, you know, the remains themselves are the remains. There's nothing that you can do about that. Personally, I find it worse when you're actually at a crime scene, for example, and you can see the context and people's belongings, you know, and in their own homes, or with the war crimes investigations, for example, you can see it's very obvious what's happened. That tends to be more distressing than actually just looking at remains in a lab or in a mortuary potentially. And you just do find yourself very much focusing on the science and on trying to answer the questions and just trying to get the best information possible out of that case so that you can help with the investigation, really. So I think quite often if you do become affected by cases, and people do, you know, we're all human, it tends to be afterwards. So it'll tend to be afterwards when you've done everything that you could and you've, you know, you've answered all the questions that you possibly can. And it's when you've got time to think about things, really, that sometimes things can get to you a little bit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Julie, listening to the extraordinary lengths that you went to try and prove beyond reasonable doubt that it was a bone, and likely human bone, in the fire, I'm wondering what eventually were the conclusions you passed on to the police who were investigating April's murder?
So, as I mentioned previously, we gave opinion on each of the larger fragments in terms of how confident we were and that they were burnt bone. We were able to say that we thought they were burnt fragments of the cranium, so they'd come from the skull, that they were consistent in terms of the size with that of a child, but we obviously couldn't say for sure that it was April. I was also asked to comment on how I thought the fragments came to be in the fire and whether I thought that the whole body had been burned in the fire, given what I knew about the case and the time frame, the length of time that the fire had been burning and the length of time that April had been missing and when Mark Bridger was arrested, for example. So I was given a kind of scenario and said that, do you think that this could be the whole body and this is all that's left of it? Or is there some other explanation? And my opinion was that the whole body hadn't been burnt on the fire because, as I explained earlier, there just weren't enough representative fragments. Normally, you'll see parts of the skeleton from every area of the skeleton, not just the skull. There should have been fragments of unerupted teeth because of April's age. There should have been fragments of long bone, of arms and legs, which normally survive really well. And even if he'd been, you know, really stoking the fire and mixing the remains around, you still would have expected just a bigger quantity of bone and ash in the fire had the whole body been put on there. So my interpretation was that these fragments had actually just got there as part of a cleanup process, potentially, so that they'd been put in the fire maybe on a rag or a cloth that had been used to clean the floor. Certainly there was evidence of the floor being cleaned and singed rags in the fire, which could support that interpretation. I wasn't aware of that work before I kind of put this forward as a suggestion. But when I found out that was one of the hypotheses that the biologists were putting forward, it did seem to fit with my interpretation that wasn't a whole body and that perhaps these fragments had been put in there. They'd been put in the fire rather than being left behind, really, was my interpretation. Mm.
I seem to remember that the plug hole that you spoke of earlier, there was a bone fragment found in the plug hole, isn't that right?
Yeah, there were a couple of small fragments as well that had gone, I think, from the bathroom plug hole, but it was too small and too contaminated. It wasn't burnt, so it was sent for DNA analysis, but they couldn't get a full profile from it. It was just too degraded and too contaminated, so unfortunately it wasn't possible to identify that or to certainly put an identity to it.
Julie, I seem to remember that the defence team in court challenged this idea that it was bone that was found. What was their challenge to your evidence?
Their challenge was that it wasn't possible to tell. It wasn't much of a challenge, really, to be honest, because it didn't offer an alternative hypothesis. It just said, you can't tell. It actually said it's not possible to tell rather than you cannot tell. So the expert for the defence was saying that it wasn't possible to tell that such small fragments were burnt human cranial bone. And our argument, obviously, was that it was possible because of all these tests that we'd done and the experts that we'd involved. We also consulted an expert, a professor in histology from the UK, as well as Professor Cattaneo in Milan as well. And we were confident that given all the different work that we'd done on it, so the comparison of the shape and looking at the different sutures with the different animals, the histology work under the microscope, the SEM analysis, we were confident that we'd done as much as we possibly could and that we could say that there was very strong evidence to suggest that some of the fragments were burnt cranial human bone.
Well, I mean, as we know, the jury didn't believe that. They believed your and the prosecution's evidence against Marks Bridger, and he was put away for life and has since, I believe, said that he did spread the remains around and put quite a lot in the river at the back of his house. So that's also debated, I believe.
I didn't know that. I didn't actually know that. So, yeah, that's interesting to hear.
Yeah, the police, he says he put it in the river.
Right.
The police think that given his movements and his background, as you alluded to earlier, that he had spread it around the various places in the woods he'd been, and
really?
That everything's somewhere different, and that, you know, as you say, the parts in the fire were part of a cleanup.
Right. Okay.
I mean, it seems to me like an extremely challenging case for you in terms of the evidence that you had to work on. There was so tiny.
Yeah.
And you had to go to such lengths. Is it how you remember it now as being one of the more challenging cases you've come across?
Absolutely, definitely. And it's not just the fact that you had so little to work with, also the fact that the rest of the remains weren't found, because all the way through we were very conscious that these were the only fragments that we had that were potentially April. So the more we tested, most of the testing is destructive. So the more we tested, the less April's family actually have to bury. So every decision that we made about every test that we conducted was done very much in consultation with the police, who then consulted with April's family to say, do you want this to go ahead? You know, you may be left with, we would never have got to the point where they were left with nothing. But each time we did one of those tests, they were going to be left with a little bit less. So it was, how far do you go? And obviously they wanted to try everything that they could to get a positive identification. But at the same time, we were having or the police family liaison officers were having very sensitive conversations with them about, this is what's going to happen. This is what it means. Even if we do this, we're not necessarily going to be any more confident. This is as good as you're going to get. So that added an extra dimension of stress to it, I suppose, and also just making sure that we'd explored every avenue, and also being challenged as well on a case like that, because that then meant that everybody had to go to court. You know, if the defence expert had agreed, and obviously, you know, that's why we have the system, you know, for a fair trial and everything, so everybody gets to be heard. But had they agreed, April's parents wouldn't have had to sit through the arguments in court about whether these were or weren't fragments of April's skull, which, you know, I always think if that could have been agreed out of court, that would have been better. But the fact that the defence did want to take it so far with a challenge, I guess it's, you know, it's part of the criminal justice system, and it should happen if there is any doubt. But it just did make it that little bit more stressful and difficult, I think, for the scientists, but more so for the families having to listen to all the differing opinions.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, as I say, it's a tragic and emotional case. And thank you very much for coming back and sharing your memories of it with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for updating me as well on the case.
So in this episode, we're fortunate enough to be joined by an additional guest who worked on the case, Peter Faulding. Peter is a world-leading forensic search specialist. Peter has worked on many high-profile missing person and no-body murder investigations, including the serial killer Peter Tobin and the mysterious death of MI6 officer Gareth Williams. In 2012, he helped to coordinate the search of the woods and the river around Mark Bridger's house. Thanks for joining the podcast, Peter. So we've just heard from Julie about her search of Mark Bridger's house. You were part of the wider search team across the countryside and the river. What was your remit when you first got told about this from the police?
It was very difficult to get some clear, sort of concise information with regard to the search because the public descended, mountain rescue, cave rescue on this area. There were literally thousands of people there, which was unusual. So it was very difficult to try and get a meeting. Initially, we were told to look at the river area. It is such a large area, but Bridger could have only gone a certain distance in the time he had. So the area surrounding the local hills and the river were sort of my focus, really.
So what intelligence did you get from the police when they first called you in? Did they say, we've got this young girl who's missing, here's what she looks like? Or did you get any more information about where they were in the investigation?
Yeah, we got clear information that April Jones was missing, abducted, potentially murdered. And that was really it. All we had was CCTV footage of Bridger's car that was crossing the bridge in McInlith. You know, the picture was starting to build at this time, but it was very clear who'd done this, and we knew at that stage.
How do you decide what technology to use in a search?
The first stage of the search was the river. So we blow the boat up, and obviously in the type of river you're dealing with, it's very shallow, so we can't use a rigid inflatable boat. So we use what they call a Zodiac. So we have that, we have an engine, and with the engine, it's also got a prop card on the back to stop it. If it hits rocks, you won't break the prop off. So then we get all the equipment set up. The side scan sonar is a high frequency, 1800 kilohertz high side scan sonar, very, very high definition. And that's like a little missile that tows behind the boat. It's a towed array. The data is sent out across the riverbed. The sound wave is sent across the riverbed. And then the signals are sent back from any targets back into the computer. And then I analyze that on the computer. And then it's stored. So I can freeze that and I can make targets larger. I can measure targets. And if there is a body in the river or anything like that, or even a bag, we can actually see it very clearly. It's an excellent tool for this type of search operation. So we had a significant stretch of river to actually search.
Oh, that's fascinating, Peter. How would your sonar be able to tell the difference between, say, a bag and a rock at the bottom of the river?
Again, that's down to experience. It's not crystal clear, but you're looking for an anomaly. If there's a bottom of a river that's absolutely strewn with large rocks, then we would actually put a diver in straight away. That's what we would do. We wouldn't sonar. But when you've got a clear bottom, clear lake bed, clear riverbed, any object on there is potentially an anomaly. And then we can zoom in on that using the specialist software on the sonar, and then we can only identify it. Obviously, you've got straight edges. So if you're looking for a body, you know there's a body there. If you're looking for a dismemberment, then it's generally divers will search the water. So it varies.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the river. In the woods, and you're talking up on the hills, what were you using there to search?
Right. Well, we were fortunate enough, we had the helicopter on the search. We have our own helicopter that I fly. So we used the helicopter to do lots of aerial work around. There was a police helicopter up, but we were flying quite low level around the hills. And it's interesting because we were out around the hills, and over one area we saw a mountain trackway and then saw a drain cover that was actually left on the side of the trackway. So we immediately landed and then looked down the hole, and it was quite eerie actually walking towards this manhole. I'm thinking, this is a perfect deposition place. spot here that we've got, and potentially, unfortunately, April could be down there. So we walked towards it and looked down it, and it wasn't. I think what had happened, somebody else had probably been there, i.e. a member of the public or something, looking down these drains, and then forgot to put the cover back on.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And, you wouldn't want to fall down there in the dark if you were the farmer, it was a 6-foot drop, but we believe that was probably the situation. And then from there, we carried on flying around all the area. We got a task on top of there's a lake sort of area on top of the mountains. We landed up on there again. And then we went over the other side, up into the heavily forested area. And as we flew over, we saw this remote caravan right up in the middle of nowhere. One thing we did get briefed by the police is that Bridger was really into his Ray Mears type thing, outdoor survival. Mm. And he'd been living in the forest for probably about a month. And that's what we were told prior to this. He does his bushcraft. And we found this this remote caravan. And it sort of sent a chill down my spine, really. Because actually, at this stage, we didn't know if April was alive or dead. We had no idea, really. Mm. So that night, I planned a search. We landed the helicopter. We got some food, and it was. I remember a storm coming. It was pouring with rain, and it was misty. And we drove to the bottom of the forest where we could get to, and it was extremely boggy. And we walked and walked and walked up this mountain track all through the woods, and eventually we get to the top, and it was sort of misty, and we found this caravan by using Ordnance Survey maps, and I looked at the caravan. And I remember approaching it, thinking she could have been kidnapped, tied up. She could be in there now. Let's cross our fingers that April was alive and she's in the caravan. And this is one of the things that hadn't been seen by anybody else. We found this remote caravan. We approached it. The door just come open and we went in there, and it was strange. It was full of speakers, audio speakers, like, if you had a rock band or something, you'd have a load of speakers all covered in cobwebs. So that it, wow. Clearly no one had been in there for a long time at that stage. But again, what we did, we took all the speakers out and we searched under everything just in case, you never know. Searched the front panel, everything, took and lifted all the seats up and then put it all back. And I was so disappointed, at that stage, because, we thought that, we were potentially going to find her alive in this caravan.
Yeah, heartbreaking. We know from Julie that these bone fragments were found in the fireplace. The theory that the police put forward later is that there was some burning, there was definite, almost certainly dismemberment, and then it went into the river. What's your feeling? I mean, you searched the river. Did you feel that body parts might have escaped you there, of washed down river?
They could have been dumped anywhere in the river, but in the area we searched, there was no body parts. Things could get washed down the river. This way, if you put something in a bag and there's air in that bag, the bag will stay afloat. And if it's not weighted, it's going to float down the river. And it was a long river and it's quite fast moving. So yeah, things could have escaped an initial search. By the time we got there, everyone mounted the huge search, things potentially could have been washed away by that particular time. But in the river, the area there was searched, it was so thoroughly searched, there was absolutely nothing there.
Do you still use dogs for searches?
We don't use dogs. We use ground penetrating radar, which didn't use on this search. So I've had a lot of success with GPR over the years. And I'm still using that on the Helen McCourt case at the moment. It's a great tool. Dogs require scent. So if there's a body buried under a path and it's been buried, and the dog will not smell it. I was on a job in Bedfordshire, and there was a body laying under the rear path, and the dogs were there all week. We were working, and I was walking around, doing ground radar search, and eventually I found the gentleman under the rear path. But again, without the scent. So what they do is put the probe in, leave it 30 minutes, and you have to probe the ground to release the scent the scent. So without that scent, the dog won't find anything unless it's a fresh body. If it's laying in the woods, it will. But if it's actually under and buried, then it's very difficult for a dog to pick up.
Okay. And what about the limitations of ground penetrating radar?
It's depth. I mean, you know, generally we've got around 5 meters, so it's plenty good enough for general work. I mean, it's good for concrete. You know, it goes through concrete. If you've got a grave in under a concrete floor, we will find it. If it's generally in soil, we will find it. You know, in a heavily tree rooted area, it becomes a nuisance because you've got lots of anomalies. So where there's lots of tree roots, ground radar isn't particularly good, and that's where you use your normal search skills. You know, it's the eyes on, it's the ground sign, where ground potentially has been disturbed. But as we go on sort of, you know, 10, 20, as in Helen's case, it's 30 years, then it's you've really got to have a good eye in. And I say that's a job I'm currently working on.
Oh, you mentioned Helen there. That's really interesting because there's a fascinating book out by her mother, Marie McCourt, called Justice for Helen, about this case. What's your involvement in it?
Helen McCourt, Helen disappeared about 32 years ago. A guy was actually locked up for life. He'd done 32 years. He's been a guy called Sims. He's been released now. And it was Helen McCourt's mum, Marie McCourt, who brought in Helen's law. He would never disclose where the body was. And now it's been passed through now that the law is that, you know, you're not going to come out of prison early unless you disclose where the body is. And I'm searching an area up around the Rixton area because I've looked at all the police notes and everything, and I'm honed down to an area where a particular piece of evidence was found many, many years ago. And I'm doing some work in my own time on behalf of the family with Marie McCourt to try and locate Helen's remains. And I am actually using GPR on that as well, ground penetrating radar.
Peter, I was just wondering about the funding for these kind of searches. And I remember when I was in the police, there was a lot of money that went into these types of things. And I just wondered if that's still the case. Are the police prepared to pay whatever it costs to search for murder victims that have gone missing?
It's very limited now. I think it depends what county you're working in. I mean, if we do dive searches, you know, we're doing underwater searches, we're tasked by a county. Surrey are particularly good. They will throw lots of money at a job, and we always get good results. Some other counties may not. And the thing is now, the resources, you know, they've had their forensic budgets cut in half. You've got lots of other issues to deal with in the police now. They haven't got the numbers. If a child goes missing or a child gets kidnapped, and they will throw everything at it, absolutely. If it's a suicide victim, then it won't get all the resources. And again, that depends county by county. But the police will always do their best at the end of the day with the resources, you know, what they've got to use. And then I say that's why we get called in to do a lot of the underwater search, because we cover the whole of the southeast of England for underwater search, because they got rid of their own dive units a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting because it's such a specialised area, it feels. How did you get started in this?
Oh, long, long, long time ago. I mean, I started the dive team. Company's been going since 1995. So I've been involved in all sorts of searches from, human remains to counter-terrorist search. So we've been going a long time. I've sat on a couple of Home Office working groups and things. And I've been out to the FBI. And it's just been a long history, really. Done some time with the military a long, long time ago. So, it's just built up over the years. And today we're sort of a highly regarded team. Who gets good results.
And how's it changed over all that time, the way you search or what you're asked to do?
The search is, well, really, like ground radar hasn't changed in the last 20 years. The only thing what's changed really is the software, the platform it's running on. So I've still got the old ground radar I had 22 years ago. It still works. And it still gives us this very similar imagery to what we got today, if I'm honest. It's just processing of the imagery is slightly better. The measurement tools are slightly better in it. Side scan sonar, that's the same. I went out to America and bought side scan sonar back, and I was the first person to use it forensically back in sort of 1998, 1999. I'd done 3 years of extensive trials because we weren't using sonar in the UK. We were using divers. but a diver can only search a certain grid line and cover a minimal area, where we can cover a whole lake in a couple of hours with a side scan sonar on, say, there's your body. It's that good. So, you know, everyone we get called into, so if we get a witness drowning, and we average about 15 drownings every year, if we get a witness drowning and they say the body's in that lake, we will find that drowning victim probably within half an hour and recover them. So it's extremely quick, whereas if it was a dive search, it could take days. So the technology is the key, as long as you know how to use the technology. And, you know, I've got years of experience of using the technology. It's the same with ground radar. It's very easy to make mistakes using GPR, and you can miss targets. And I live on a lucky enough to live on a farm, and I've got alpacas. And when the alpacas die, of old age, I bury them. And I do a lot of forensic study on the farm, so identifying graves with GPR. And I've got about 10 graves on my land, again, which I hand that knowledge on to forensic students. So it's about being able to read the data, and that's the key to all search, really. And it's a bit from the military background, it's walking through a wood, and if you've got a fresh missing person, it's the ground sign looking for the broken sticks. And if you've got a fresh grave, you can see clearly that the grave's been, it's been disturbed, whereas if it's 10 years old, it's not as easy.
Well, that's all we've got time for, sadly. Peter, thank you so much for giving us this glimpse into your fascinating world of forensic searches. Thank you, Julie, Robert, Linda and Kaz, as always. And that's not just the end of this episode, but also of our third series. We hope you've enjoyed it. And if you did, then please give us a nice rating. We'll be back for series 4 with more real crimes, real forensics and real inside access. And in the meantime, we're also hoping to pull together some bonus episodes, so keep an eye out for those in your feed. Until then, enjoy Linda's new book, Vanished, which is now out in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. And if you want to know more about Linda and our guests on this podcast, then check out her website at lindalaplante.com. We'll be back for series 4. Until then, thanks so much for listening. Mm-hmm.